You're listening to the Hazard Ground Podcast, with service members from across the military sharing their stories of combat and survival. And now, here's your host, Mark Zeno.
Welcome into the Hazard Ground Podcast. As always, we appreciate you joining us each and every week. So excited for this week's episode. I know you guys are going to love it. But before we get started, want to remind you to hit those reviews on iTunes hard. The more ratings and reviews we get, the easier it is for people to find us. You don't have to leave much. Just hit that 5 stars if you like what you hear, and that's all you need to do. Or leave 5 stars and write a review and leave us some feedback. We love hearing from you, good, bad, or indifferent. We always want to hear what you guys think of the show. So again, get that rating and review on iTunes. Give us 5 stars if you love the show. Also, YouTube subscriptions, they are up, but we want to keep them growing. We now have a custom URL for our YouTube channel. Go to youtube.com/C as in Charlie/HazardGroundPodcast.com and access and subscribe to our YouTube channel. This has been really big for us. We're getting a lot of hits on YouTube and really growing the audience that way. So again, youtube.com/C/HazardGroundPodcast is the link for you to find us. Also, our Amazon promotion continuing. You're able to give back to veterans and support them just by doing your normal Amazon shopping when you go through the link on our website, hazardground.com. And oh, by the way, if you're a mobile user, you can go to our website on your smartphone or on your iPad or whatever sort of tablet you're using, hazardground.com. Click on the Amazon button. And it will take you right to the app for Amazon. That way, you don't have to go back to the website and put in all your information for your credit card and everything else. So again, hazardground.com, click on that Amazon button, and you guys can support veterans every time you do your Amazon shopping. Again, we are hoping and praying that everybody is staying safe and staying healthy. So much going on in the world, and we continue to ask that veterans and service members lead the way and set the example in continuing this challenge, this call, this struggle that America is dealing with right now. Let's be that unifying force that we all know that the military is. It's one of the most diverse organizations in the world, and we are certainly proud of that. And it's the people who help grow that diversity. It's people like you and me who serve alongside people of all different races, colors, creeds, sexual orientations, religions, whatever it may be. And that is what makes our military the strongest in the world. So be leaders in that fight as well. Speaking of fighting, an amazing guest coming up right now. And joining us this week on the Hazard Ground Podcast, a very special guest whose story you may be familiar with. He is a retired U.S. Army Spec 4 who served in Vietnam, where he was awarded the Bronze Star and a Purple Heart for his actions and injuries in August of 1969 in Hype Duck. Prior to his service, however, he was best known for being a football player, winning a national championship at Notre Dame, and then eventually, after his military career, went on to the NFL to win 4 Super Bowls with the Pittsburgh Steelers. There are 2 books out there about his story. One of them, called Fighting Back, chronicles his entire journey, and it is an amazing one. He is Rocky Blyer joining us on the Hazard Ground Podcast. Rocky, welcome, and thank you so much for being here.
Hey, thank you, Mark, and thanks for what you're doing. You know, I've always felt that, you know, stories are so very important because a lot of veterans don't necessarily tell their stories or discuss them, especially Vietnam veterans specifically. You know, I run into, and I'm sure you have in the past, I run into a lot of memory. Yeah, Dad never talked about it. My grandfather never talked about it. My uncles never, they never talked about that experience. And it's somewhat of a shame because I think that it's those stories need to be told about what you do and how you served your country. So you're doing a wonderful job of being able to bring those stories to the forefront. So thank you.
Well, thank you. I mean, and that's part of why we do it. We went into this whole thing, you know, just saying that not everybody's going to have the ability to have their story made into a book or a movie, but that doesn't mean that story doesn't hold any less importance. And sort of while chronicling history is a sense of what we're doing, but it's just great that there are stories out there that people haven't heard that they need to hear. And yours is a very popular story, but we wanted to sort of dive into, the Vietnam portion of your life as well as, you know, your post-Vietnam career, because obviously that is where everybody mostly knows you from. But kind of go back to the beginning. I know you were at Notre Dame and you graduated and got drafted, but sort of take me through the childhood up to Notre Dame. Is that always where you wanted to go?
Oh, no, that's a, you know, those, I didn't know where I wanted to go. I mean, as none of my folks didn't go to college, I graduated from high school and then went into the workforce, and then ultimately opened, after mom and dad got married, dad opened up a bar, and that became our lives for, all that period of time growing up, in Appleton, Wisconsin was a place where we lived. We lived above the bar, and that was, the daily work. So, so as I say, we weren't necessarily Notre Dame fans. And I always like to tell the story. I mean, we weren't anybody fans, Green Bay fans, but that wasn't big until the 60s, University of Wisconsin, but we didn't have all the, exposure that college sports has today, and or professional sports. Back then, you had the radio and you had your newspaper, and it wasn't as much of a conversation piece, even at the bar. So when it came down and I got the opportunity to take a look at some colleges, and I always tell people, I said, when I had to make a decision of schools that I had had an opportunity to go to, one was Notre Dame, and probably the best piece of advice that I got was from the Notre Dame recruiter. Ultimately, as I look back on it, it was kind of a sales technique, but it worked for me, in which he said that, you're going to get a lot of scholarships from a lot of different schools. And every time you go visit one of those schools, they're going to roll out the red carpet. So by the time you visit 5, 6, 7, or 8, or how many, all of a sudden you have to make that choice. All those experiences kind of fold together and it makes it more difficult. Why don't you just choose 3 schools that you would like to graduate from, not necessarily play football at, but just to graduate from, because you never know what's going to happen during your career. And so I thought, well, that made just logical sense. And so I cut it down to the University of Wisconsin for my state college, Boston College, another Catholic school, and Notre Dame. And like I tell people, I said, well, I did what every good Catholic boy was taught to do, and that was go to church
exactly.
And pray for guidance, And then, like every good Catholic boy, I did what my mother wanted me to do, and that was go to Notre Dame. And that's how and that's basically how I got there. But who would know, at that time, a change come in, a brand new coach from Northwestern University, Ara Parseghian, and all of a sudden he turns a program around that was a lagging through the 50s in early part of the 60s. And then, bam, by my junior year, I get to play on a team that is crowned a national championship football team. There weren't playoff games as they have them today, so it was kind of a national vote. But it was a great experience. Mm-hmm. And because of that success, that's the only thing that really got me recognized. So I get drafted in the National Football League, as that story goes, by the Pittsburgh Steelers. Not a highly touted draft choice. I was a 417th person picked in the draft. I was a 16th round draft choice. But from my point of view, there were 17 rounds. At least I was not the last guy picked. And so I made the team. I made the team. 4 rookies made the team that year, and special teams primarily. And so that gave me an opportunity to get a taste of the NFL. But also, that was 1968, or the fall of 1968. And it was the height of the war over in Vietnam. I remember a change in my career, or an unknown change, and I was at in training camp, and it was towards the end of training camp, probably right at the end of August and September, right maybe the first part of September. And Bill, our head coach, he pulled me aside and said, "Listen," he said, "I got this letter in the mail. We opened it by mistake, and it was my 1A draft classification." Notice. And he said, "We think you're good enough to make the team, and we'll take care of this for you."
Oh,
whatever,
really?
Whatever taking care of this meant, meaning in my mind, well, we'll get you in the reserve or the National Guard. Most players, at that time, that was an option that was viable. So as time went on and time went on, and so then the excuses built up, of, you know, I'm sorry, the general retired, the congressman got defeated, you know, our contacts isn't working. But it was 1968. It was the height of the war. We had most people over in Vietnam at that time, over 500,000 veteran or military personnel. And so the reserves, National Guard, were filled. And, you know, and they could call whatever shots they wanted to at the time. And it was one of those where it just kind of slipped through, and and I got my draft notification, and it was, we were getting ready for a game. I think it was 11th game of the season, and then I was sitting in the locker room, and all of a sudden, one of the equipment guys holler, "Hey, Blyer, there's a letter over here for you." And so I jumped up and walked over to the table and picked it up and opened it up and said, "Greetings. We'd like to inform you that you've been inducted into the armed service of your country." to report the next morning.
Wow.
At 7 a.m. I said, "You got to be kidding me. Don't you give you a week, you know?" And so from that point on, my life was, you know, up in a turmoil. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, it just went. And part of me, and in all honesty, as I look back and reflect on that, you know, of going into the service, was that, you know, it was somewhat of a, you know, a relief of wanting to live up to one's responsibilities, you know, and why people join the service for one reason or another. Wasn't popular back at that period of time, but ultimately my uncles had served, my father hadn't, he had been ill. But, you know, you wanted to, I guess, you know, if other people serve, then why not you as well? And maybe that's a rationale that you accept that, you know, that movement. But then you go through, you know, basic training, advanced infantry training.
Right.
It was like camp again all over. And then you get your orders. And obviously, you know, my orders went to Vietnam and ended up in May of 69 over in Vietnam.
Rock, let me ask you real quick. When you decided to go to college, was there any thought that, you know, at that time, if you went to college, you weren't able to be drafted? Did you think in going to college, was it even a conversation with the family? Like, hey, we'll at least be able to avoid Vietnam for 4 years, maybe it'll be over by then. Was there any sort of, you know, of that thought process?
No. I would like to think that there was, but there wasn't, you know, at that time. It was just, you know, you got your student deferment, you know, so for those 4 years, you get your student deferment. And, you know, and I had, you know, friends that I went to high school with, like, you know, everybody else. Some, you know, flunked out of school, dropped out of school, went into the service because that was the only option that they had, or they got drafted and went. It did their time with a couple years. And so at that time, you know, if you got drafted, it was a 2-year commitment with a 6 years of reserve thereafter to fulfill your obligation to our country. So that was what was taking place. But that was the furthest thing from my mind. I really didn't concentrate, nor did we talk about it. You know, it was just kind of there, and you wait and see, you know, what had taken place. What would take place later on. I mean, I didn't even think about ROTC because that was a commitment.
Right.
You know, and it's not that I thought about playing professional football, but that option, you know, it was kind of there, just, you know, whatever, you know, hopefully maybe, you know, that it would take place. So I just went the usual route of everybody else during that period of time and, you know, waited to see what took place thereafter.
I'm just curious, you know, you get to basic training and everything. Was there anything at that time that basic training was sort of like football for you? Was it like football camp at all? Was it tougher? Was it harder?
it was different. I mean, it wasn't tougher or harder. I mean, it was just different because of the drill sergeants, you know,
right.
Because of, But in all honesty, it was kind of the same. You had coaches that yelled at you. You know, you had a responsibility. You had drills you had to do. You know, you had to go to practice, whether it be in high school or college. You know, so there was a time factor. So it wasn't foreign. And coming from a playing season, you know, I was in pretty good shape at that time compared to somebody who had not worked out or not done anything or get ready for basic training. So it was, you know, you just, not that I'm saying basic training was a breeze, you know, but you got through it maybe better than some other other young men.
Did anybody at basic training recognize you and go, "Are you Rocky Blyer from the Steelers?"
No, you know, not when, not when you're the 417th person picked in the draft.
I guess that's true, but still, you know, you played a full season in the NFL. Might have had some kid from Pittsburgh in there who knew everything about the team. So, you know, just on the off chance somebody recognized you.
Yeah. No, not really. I mean, so it wasn't as if I was a highly touted, you know, player that got drafted. You know, I wasn't as if I was a starter or an All-American, you know, from Notre Dame or in the news all the time, you know. So eventually, you know, it got around, but nothing, you know, there was nothing to do about it, you know, so I didn't get any special attention because of it, you know. So.
All right, so 6 months after you raise your right hand, you end up in South Vietnam. What are you told? Where are you going? Sort of what's your mission? What do you know about, you know, leading up to the events, getting into Vietnam?
Yeah, nothing. I mean, I didn't know anything about where we're going, what we're going to do, except Vietnam and the stories that you saw on the news and the stories you heard from your high school friends who had already served, you know, or were still in the service, but, you know, you got a chance to talk to or so on, and what their experiences were at that time. And mostly it was all within your own imagination of what was taking place. So we're flying over to Vietnam. I didn't know what to expect. We flew into Saigon, and you go, "Oh, okay, fine. You know, is there going to be a firefight on that runway? You know, are they going to bomb us? Are they going to shoot at us?" And then we got into buses, and the buses, you know, had barbed wire. They had like fencing over the windows so that nobody obviously could throw a hand grenade into the window. You're going, "Oh man, are they going to shoot you on the way?" And so you get to camp, you know, and you unloaded, and you went to your barracks, you know, so you had to go through an indoctrination period of time and get familiar with what. Then we went through some jungle training while we were there before we got to our unit. And I can remember when I finally got to my unit, and I went from Saigon to Da Nang and up to Chu Lai, and then from Chu Lai, I went out to my unit that they assigned me to, the Charlie Company, 4th of the 31st, 196th Light Infantry Brigade, Marical Division. I didn't know any of that stuff or what it meant at that time. And so I got there, and we landed on LZ West, which was one of the two operating landing zones in which we worked from, as Siberia was the other one. And my company, who had then was pulling perimeter guard to protect the heavy weapons that were up there, had every day. Now I find the routine is that they take sweeps off of that mountain, go down into the valley, take a sweep, and then climb back up that mountain every day. So nobody's there. I'm waiting for them. They kindly come up about 5 o'clock in the evening. And my first reaction was, holy man. I mean, they all looked older than they were. They looked beat, dragged. They had this almost like a 1,000-yard stare at times. And I'm going, oh, what did I get myself into here? And so I met then my platoon sergeant, and then he met the captain. He assigned me to, you know, first squad. We're in the first platoon. And so that was it. Met my squad guys. And then they decided that I was going to hump the M79. Grenade launcher. Mm-hmm. So they get, okay, fine. You know, that'll be, you'll be a good guy, grenadier. That'll be it. He can carry all those grenades. Well, yeah. I didn't know I had to carry the grenades. Holy man. So they packed you with 60 grenades, you know.
Oh, God.
Back, and they were, holy man. It was, well, it was better than either that or humping the M60, which I didn't want to do either. So, but anyway, but that was my first, you know, experience. And it just was, I guess maybe I was the first new guy to come into the company in 3 months. And so, you know, everybody else was getting ready, or after a couple months to go on R&R. So we'd lose them here and there, and then they'd come back. And that was an experience.
You mentioned before that a lot of the buildup in your mind getting there, you know, sort of allowed your imagination to run away with you about what was really going on there. When you get there and you go out on a couple of patrols and you go through sort of everyday life, did any of that imagination match up with reality, or was it just completely different in your eyes?
You know, I think at first you're very leery of, you know, what's taking place or what you're running into, you know. And then so how it worked was that you'd spent 7 to 10 days, maybe up on an LZ, and then you'd rotate down into the field. And then you'd be in the field running maneuvers for that same period of time. Then you go up to another LZ, you know, and then you just rotate out of the four companies that were stationed in that area. And so it kind of became routine, you know, and you keep your eyes open, and whatever information you received about activity, you know, it was okay, fine. Clear this. We got to clear that whole area. So the big thing was the villagers that were out there. What they tried to do was to bring every villager into a what we call Tin City, but into a protective area, so that anybody that was out in a village, and especially male, you know, from the age of, oh, let's just say 10, you know, to 60, you know, was, if you're not in the village, then what are you doing here? And if you're here, so you're either Viet Cong and or you're with the NVA, you know, other, or yeah, because if you're with the Arvins, which is the South Vietnamese army, then you're not in this area.
Right.
So then that became, you know, then that became the target. And then we'd get information down in this area, what has taken place. But, you know, so you would move. So you'd be in the field, you know, you get up in the morning, grab a cup of coffee, you know, put your rucksack together, throw it on your back. You know, now we're humping here, and we're humping here till noon. Then we break for lunch, have another afternoon, and then leave from there and set up night surroundings later on. And, you know, so that became kind of the routine. And you just listen to what the information was. You know, there could be activity here. There is activity here. And and there was a couple missions that we had taken place that were search and destroy missions. People shouldn't be here. So we go in, if we run into a village or whatever, you know, a couple, well, then you had to destroy those, you know, and, you know, flush out the people if there's anybody there, you know, move them. And so those were intense at times. And you just didn't know what was going to take place. So, you know, and it was just that. And it was, you know, sometimes it got boring and boring and boring. And, you know, then you run into a couple of actions, and but then that was it. And they would disappear. And so then you continue on your mission.
When you say run into action, I mean, how often was this happening? And
you know, it's an interesting thing, because I think, you know, and maybe within the stories that you have told in the past for those who had served, and I think it's pretty much the same no matter what area, whether you're in the Middle East or whether you're in the Far East, in a conflict situation is that it's boring. I mean, it's
Groundhog Day.
It's boring. It's boring. It's every day, every day, every day. You just got to be, you know, somewhat alert on the situation. It's, you know, and it's not as if there's action all the time. There's not as if there's a big fight. There's not as if there's a front or rear. You're just out there doing your search and destroy and or search methods or going through, you know, trying to. Whatever information came down from intel and what you're kind of looking for. So ultimately for us, unbeknownst to us as soldiers at the time, was that there was a big military action that was taking place that ultimately led into Hep Duck Valley. And as I said, and that's where we were. And Hep Duck was the tin city that we were protecting. And the NVA came down in regiments to free the Death Valley area. And so we ultimately were in a pincer movement with the Marines who were north of us. They were pushing down the NVA into our area. We were to be a retaining force. As they came down. So that was during that period of time, and that's where the action really had taken place. So, ultimately for us, sister company had been hit. They were in the field by an NVA regiment. So they were in a firefight. We then had to fly out to get them out of the hot spot that day. So we came in. Enemy retreated. We pulled them out, carrying what dead and helping what wounded that didn't get out earlier with the helicopters. It was late at night. Then we ran into a quick fire fight, and ultimately the word was to leave the bodies that we were carrying out. Let's move out of here before they get our position and start mortaring us. And so we did. And now 2 days later, we got reinforced by another company. Mm-hmm. We were going back to retrieve the bodies that we had left behind. That was our quick mission. And in so doing, we were walking on an open rice paddy. My point man, all of a sudden saw movement across the berm. And in his excitement, and it's just human nature, in his excitement, rather than being a veteran, and stopping, taking a knee, assessing the situation, he hollered, "Gook, gook," shots broke the stillness, they started to retreat, he started to chase them, pulling everybody out in the middle of the rice paddy when a machine gun started to level the area. So bodies were diving left and right to get out of arm's way. I dove into a rice paddy. There was another one below us. Four guys were pinned down out in the open. My responsibility, because I was a grenadier, was to get some firepower on that position. And so, so that was when I got hit the first time. And then we dropped back and got enough firepower to get the four guys who were pinned down out of there. And we dropped back, set up another defensive position, rest of the guys out of the field. We lost two guys in the field at that time, another wounded. And they probed our perimeter, got close, hand grenade come flying in. And it hit my commanding officer right in the middle of the back, and I was right next to him, and it bounced off. And, it's one of those quick reactions, it bounces off, doesn't go off, and it starts rolling towards where you are. So, your reaction is to jump out of the way. And as I did, I was standing on top of it, and it blew up through my right foot, knee, and thigh. I think that it was a cheap grenade. So, then we were in another firefight that afternoon when a sister platoon finally fought its way down to help us out of there and then pulled us back to safety. And, it went back to a place called Million Dollar Hill, and it was extracted from that position, and then spent the rest of my time in the hospital.
That date, August 20th, when you were injured, you know, you mentioned that you were going back out to get bodies. Did you know any of the guys or the bodies that you were going to get that day?
No, no, I didn't know because okay. it was a sister company. So we didn't, you know, it was just, I didn't, you know, yeah, I, you know, hardly knew other guys in my company, you know? And so you knew the guys that were in your squad, basically, because that's where you hung out with, you know, getting a couple other guys that you know, that you knew from other other squads. But this was a whole different, you know, company. And so we had no interaction specifically with that company. So, yeah, no, I didn't know any of those.
Did you lose any guys? Were any guys KIA while you were going to get the bodies on August 20th? I know you said somebody was wounded, but did anybody get killed?
Yes. Yeah, we lost four guys. Okay. I think it was five guys that got killed that day. And yeah, that was a shame.
You know, and I know this is a difficult question to answer, but, you know, you're sitting there with a bullet in your leg and, you know, you're missing part of your foot and you got shrapnel everywhere, but yet you lost four of your buddies. Are you more thankful to be alive, or is the loss of those guys sort of weighing on you more at that point in time?
No, I think, you know, let's be honest, we're human beings, you know, so you think about yourself, you know, you think,
sure.
Okay,
yeah.
Fine, God, you know, here I am, you know, so you hear. Now, for me, maybe the good thing was that I didn't see them die. I didn't see them get blown up or shot, you know. It was a report. So-and-so got hit. So-and-so is down. So-and-so is not moving. So-and-so's, and then ultimately afterwards, when you kind of get all the information together, they said, yeah, you know, we lost so-and-so and so-and-so, and we lost four guys. We lost, you know, out of that and being wounded with 2/3 of our company, that day. So, it was a big day.
Now, you mentioned you went to the hospital and you were in Tokyo, you know, continuing rehabbing and getting well there. How long were you there for?
So in Tokyo, I was there in 2 weeks. I think it was 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks I was in Tokyo. So the biggest thing at that time was to get the wounded personnel out of country because of infection. So I went to, So we left the battlefield. I went to an aid station. I got to Da Nang, and I was in Da Nang for about 2-3 weeks, where they assess the wounds and the situation, wrap you as you best possibly can, you know, take care of whatever openings, but they're not going to operate unless it was an emergency, you know. So they ship you out of country into, and so we went to Tokyo. So I got to Tokyo. And then you just, you know, you process in, we're in the hospital, doctor comes through, assess your wounds, what needs to be done. And one of the things that I found out later that it was a big concern was they couldn't do any, I had a staph infection.
Mm-hmm.
In my leg, and it was moving up. And so they had to stabilize that infection before they could move me, you know, and or if it got worse, amputate my leg. So they didn't tell me that right away until later, thank God.
Right.
So we get through. So we get through that process, and so that was it was an interesting thing because there was a good doctor there, Dr. Leor, who is our physician, and so after maybe a couple weeks, you know, I didn't know the extent of the damage that was taking place, and so my question to him was, do you think I can play football again? You know, wait, what do you think? And his response was, yeah, don't worry about it. You know, you're going to have a normal life. Do the things as normal people. Just don't expect to get back in the gridiron. You won't have the strength or the flexibility to do the things that are necessary to be a running back in the NFL. And kind of as my authority figure, it just kind of sucked that hope right out, and you know, about whatever that future might be. But the interesting thing, and it's just a little thing, but as the story goes, I got a 2 days later, I got a postcard in the mail, simple postcard, had two lines on it. It said this: Rock, team's not doing well. we need you, Art Rooney, owner of the team.
Wow.
It's like somebody needed me. Well, they didn't need me, you know, but it was that kind of a graciousness that reached out to kind of change an attitude that, you know, somebody out there that cares. And, you know, so you move that forward.
Hey, everybody, just a quick pause from the podcast to give you a word about my friends at My Front Page Story. Look, Father's Day is coming up, and if your dad is anything like mine, your dad loves the newspaper. I think everybody's dad loves the newspaper. Well, give him the cover story he deserves for being such an awesome dad at MyFrontPageStory.com. Guys, I did this for my mother on Mother's Day, and I can tell you she was so emotionally moved by what My Front Page Story does. It is the absolute perfect gift for Father's Day as well. Telling your dad you had a story written about him as a gift for Father's Day is pretty much the coolest thing you can tell someone when giving a gift. Watching him read it and trying not to get choked up, just like my mom did, will be even better. What happens is you'll talk to a writer for about 10 minutes about your dad, and they'll write an amazing story about him and send it to you, and he will love it. I guarantee you, it is an absolute win of a gift. So instead of going the old route for Father's Day, you know, socks, a tie, a gift card, give him something that he'll actually remember forever, and go to MyFrontPageStory.com and be sure to use the promo code HazardGround20. Once again, MyFrontPageStory.com and the promo code HazardGround20 to set up an interview today to tell the story about your dad on Father's Day. MyFrontPageStory.com and the promo code HazardGround20. Now back to this week's episode. I want to ask you, you know, as you're leaving the battlefield, as you're being flown out of Vietnam back to America, you know, to start putting your life back together, is there any sense of guilt, or does that come much later? Were you just happy to get the hell out of there and be alive? I mean, kind of take me through the thoughts.
Oh, yeah. You know, so I can, so here, you know, so here, now they're dragging me, okay? I mean, as let's get to the point where the sister company comes in, you know, and the first guy that comes to me is a corporal that I know from that company and I know, or from the platoon. So he comes in, he said, "Oh my God, you all right?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Oh, thank God." He said, "Because we got the call that you and Tom, Captain Murphy, who was our captain, bought it and had been killed." So, don't worry. He said, "Well, I'll get you out of here." He said, "You'll be the first guy out of here. Okay. We'll go." And I said, "Okay, fine." So he came back. He said, "No, Captain Murphy's the first guy. You're going to be the second guy out of here." I said, "Okay, fine." So, and so because of the injuries in both legs, they had to carry me out, and they carried me out on a poncho liner. So they've got four guys, you know, they got to carry a corner, you know, and then drag you on a poncho liner. Just to get you out of here. Now, here's four guys that they've been since the break of dawn as well. They've had their own battle to fight through to get to where we are. And so now it's later in the afternoon going into the evening. Now they got to drag 170 pounds. I lost a lot of weight of dead meat, you know, through the jungles. And that's not the easiest thing to do. Oh, and they did. And they dragged me and they dragged me and they dragged me and they set me down. You know, guys would pass me. They set me down. And we got to a point where they were beat and tired. I mean, honest to God, they just couldn't. They said, "Okay, fine. We're going to send a stretcher back. You know, don't worry. We'll send somebody back." Now, here's an interesting thing, because all of a sudden during that period of time, and I'm saying this in all honesty, two black hands reach out of the darkness, scoop me up, and my fellow soldier picks me up and throws me over his shoulder and starts carrying me to the helicopter. And the helicopter, honest to God, the helicopter was a long ways away, and he would put me down, my blood all over him, catch his breath, pick me up, and continue on until he got me to the base of the hill. And then he got a stretcher and took me up to the top. But he carried me, you know, and you think about things that are happening today within our black communities and right. Injustice. When you think about the brotherhood of war, mm-hmm. There is no color barrier. You know, you're just a fellow soldier. And, you know, he was an instrumental. And the thing about it was I didn't know who he was. Didn't know where he came from. Didn't know where he lived. Never saw him since that incident.
And you never got his name.
Never got his name.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, but, you know, so he gets me to the, you know, to the helicopter. Finally, we get up there. And so a medic comes over. He says, is there anything I can get you? And I said, yeah, give me a shot. Give me something. Holy man. I didn't get anything, you know, through this period of time. Adrenaline was working its way off. So he gave me a morphine shot. And I said, well, give me another one. He said, no, I can't do that. He said, because I need to have you be awake when they assess what your injuries were. But, you know, so it's, you know, it's those little stories. So you don't, you know, yeah, you don't think about guilt. You don't think about until later, you know, until what happens. Or you think yourself is lucky, and or you think, well, you know, you feel, well, that's part of life or war or whatever took place. It's, you know, and I can understand, where if I'm a leader, you know, within a group, if I'm, you know, a sergeant or if I'm in charge and I lose my group, I lose my people, and I'm the only one that lives, you know, I can understand that. You know, I can understand that guilt and, you know, that loss that you should have done something more. And that becomes difficult to handle at times.
Okay. I want to fast forward before we get to the football stuff and come back to it, because I'm curious. For those who, you know, are familiar with Rocky's story, and you may know, you, like many other Vietnam veterans, had the opportunity to go back to Vietnam 50 years after you were there. And I've talked to a variety of Vietnam vets on the podcast, and they all get a different experience from this. I'm curious, why did you go back? What were you hoping to accomplish in the trip and, you know, the experience? What did it mean to you?
So the reason I went back was because ESPN had talked about it.
Okay.
They thought, you know, actually it was a process. It was a 10-year process to be able to do that. And we'd talk about it, and then these schedules didn't work out, and, you know, and then things slipped. But anyway, so they said, well, no, I think we would like to go back with you and do that. I mean, it's a part of your story. And, you know, and I said, okay, fine. Here's the deal. I don't know what you are going to expect. I said, because of the fact, unlike the majority of returning Vietnam veterans who had to suppress their feelings, who were spat upon, who were looked down upon because at that period of time, you were identified with the conflict, unpopular conflict, so you were unpopular. Not that you served your country, but you were unpopular. And so they had to repress their feelings and become quiet. And they had nobody to talk to. They had no place to go. The VFWs weren't open to them. The American Legions weren't open to them. They went about their lives as they best possibly could. I said, I come back to a high profile. And so now I become a story. And so over those 40 some years, now 50 years, you know, I've told that story. So I've gone through a catharsis of that period of time.
Right.
There isn't anything that I hadn't already, you know, come or emotional about. So I said, yeah, so let's go back. We'll it'll be fun to kind of see what takes place. You know, and they had a couple things that were lined up. An interview with an Arvin soldier that was actually there in Hep Duck during the same period of time that I was there. And we found the exact location of the exact spot where we got hit in that rice paddy. So we went back there. Now, my reaction, and I'm going to tell you this, my reaction was very unexpected on my part. As we're driving from Da Nang to Chu Lai, it's about an hour and a half drive. I'm sitting in an air-conditioned van, and I'm just looking at the scenery. Now, it's a busy, hectic scenery. I mean, there are roadways, there are townships, there are, you know, there's buildings going on, there's commerce taking place, there's motorbikes, cars on the road. I mean, it's kind of like a hustle bustle going from one place to another place. And I'm just, you know, thinking, well, okay, fine, you know, subconsciously. And then we're driving by LZ West. And I said, what's that? And they said, that's LZ West. I said, oh, okay, fine. Obviously a place where we operated from. And I had taken sweeps out into this area here, which was all rice paddies and jungles and, you know, a village popped up here and there. So what a change in 50 years. Suppressed that feeling, I'm sure, until we finally found the spot. We got there, and Tom Rinaldi, we're doing the interview, and he said, so what are you feeling? Out of the blue, this emotion came over me that I couldn't understand, nor quickly in my mind know where it came from, that came from really the like the soles of my feet up through my body. I could just feel it and just erupted inside of me of this emotional reaction. And I didn't know where it was coming from. And that was a frustrating thing. I didn't know where that was coming from. And so I almost felt sick inside. You know, it like flushed my system. And I said, I have to go and sit down. And we did that. And so it was, I sat down and bam, I passed out. And so my blood pressure dropped and, you know, and that was the scenario. And so ultimately came to you and we went back to Da Nang and I had to go see a doctor and get some IVs and all that kind of stuff. But but the situation was okay. Where subconsciously it was all the change, and then it was the understanding of well, why? I mean, if you think about what had taken place over in that conflict, you know, after all these years, that 58,000 military personnel died for what? It's still in not for what, but still, it's you know, it's still a communist country. Although they love Americans and, you know, and we got great commerce going back and forth. But for what reason and for why? And that became the emotional, that I couldn't come to terms with, in that question. And I think that was that spurred that emotional reaction at the time. And it gave me a sense, maybe it gave me a sense of what it's like to have post-traumatic stress. And people who have to live with that, military personnel, maybe first responders, you know, who all of a sudden life's going fine, and then bam, you open the door and you step off a cliff, and it hits you. And so that gave me that little sense of people who live with it for most of their lives, or have to deal with mental health issues that. That come from experiences like that. So that was my feeling.
Yeah,
that's where we went back.
And again, I just when you talk about it, see, I've always thought that about myself. Like one day, I there's a part of me that really hopes to be able to go back to Iraq. You know, after two deployments there, and just kind of walk the same ground again. And
right. When
I think about what I would feel, I almost get emotional. I quickly just kind of turn my mind off because. So much of you is left out on the battlefield. And, you know, it's a theme we talk about a lot. No matter what you go through in battle, that person you were before dies. You're never the same person again. And you're completely changed. And as you should be, because the experience of combat is unlike anything on earth. And so I hear you talk about it. And I could feel that sort of emotion building in me, wondering if I'll be consumed the same way if I ever get that opportunity. And part of me almost like fears the opportunity because I'm afraid of all those emotions that I'm not really aware of that I'm still having.
Right. You know, and so I've also run into Vietnam veterans. And I think that what I'm going to say is that it's really what your experience was during that period of time that you served or were in country. You know, so I have also run into people who really enjoyed going back, you know, going back to Saigon or Da Nang wherever they were, and seeing the changes and, you know, seeing the ocean and the beaches and so on and so on. So a lot of times, and, you know, those who worked in the rear and support mechanisms and so on, you know, have a different experience than those that were on the front lines, so to speak. And I'm happy for them. I'm not pointing out what's better or not, because everybody served at any one time. But sometimes it's just that experience and how you deal with what you had gone through.
Do you regret making the trip?
No, not at all. Not at all. Okay. I mean, not at all. I was happy. I was happy to be able to do that. You know, it's somewhat embarrassing to be on camera and, you know, and break down like a little kid and cry and then ultimately faint. But the biggest thing was I did tell him, I said, oh, okay, fine. It was very nice narrative. Thank you very much. But did you have to say, you know, he was overcome by heat stroke? You know, I mean, like heat stroke, that was like an old guy thing. Oh, no, he's so old that a heat stroke had taken him down. I mean, couldn't you say emotional?
Right. Emotional stress as opposed to heat stroke.
Emotional
right.
Emotional stress. Yeah, that's right.
All right. Well, let's kind of get back to, you know, your life after you get home from Vietnam. Again, for those who don't know, immediately you go back to the Steelers. Now you spend basically 18 months on injured reserve. Before you can get back to playing, right? So what is the doctor tells you you're probably not going to play in the NFL. You're not going to be able to play football. Is that something that's motivating you?
Well, yeah. Yeah, no, so what do doctors know? I mean, I always say it's not that, you know, but it's a perception about what takes place. So anybody who has been involved in sports, you know, and played, or no matter what level, not that it has to be high school or college, you know, but let's just say this, lessons that we learned, bumps and bruises and scrapes that we get playing in the backyard or neighborhood or pickup games, you know, continued, you know, so what do you learn? You learn that, well, you got an injury. Okay. It hurts. You see a doctor. Okay. Then it heals. And then you got to kind of go through rehab and then all of a sudden you're back in the backyard again playing. And it's a process. So it's a mindset that we go through. In this case specifically, you know, I was damaged, but I did an arm. I didn't lose a leg, you know. I mean, it's still operated, maybe not as efficiently as before, but we've had injuries before. So you overcome them. You have to start doing all the things that are necessary. So the biggest thing was just getting an opportunity and being with an organization like the Steelers. And at that time, I came back in 1970 and tried out, and it beat me up. I mean, it was two-a-day sessions, and I get my weight back, but, you know, it's just you get an injury, and, you know, so I was limping through practice, blah, blah, blah. They released me, put me on injured reserve. I had another operation. Let me heal, come back the following year, and ultimately went through that training camp, and they put me on the taxi squad. Okay, so bought me 2 years to kind of hang around, 2 years to be there, go through practice, you know. But it was actually 2 years to see a change or a growth in what you do with that opportunity. And so I come back in 1972. I'm bigger, stronger, faster, and get a chance to play. Fortunately, we got 6 exhibition games. I get enough time in the exhibition games to play. I'm the leading ground gainer during the exhibition. Not that it means anything, except for the fact that I made the team. Never carried the ball thereafter. Played special teams, you know, in that whole season in 72. Came back in 73. A little bigger, stronger. Got a chance to play. I carried the ball once during that season. It was again. Special teams. And then 74, I come back. Which was a big struggle for me to do so in 74, only because you know, you're just kind of hanging on. In 74, the starting running backs were already predetermined, backups predetermined. For me to make the team again, I was going to have to fight with every free agent, rookie, and draft choice, and almost quit that year, not come back in 74. But I got my arm twisted, and I came back and ended up as a leading ground gainer. Mm-hmm. Again, during the exhibition season. And I tell people that only because of the fact that, you know, the reason I was the leading ground gainer, because I played more than anybody else. I carried the ball more than anybody else because they're trying to cut me or get rid of me for whatever reason. And so all they were providing for me was an opportunity to make this team. So they had to keep me. I was back playing special teams. But things happen. Franco gets hurt. Backup gets put in at fullback. Backup gets hurt. I'm the third guy. So I get a chance to play. Franco comes back. They move me to halfback. And all of a sudden we start to win. And we win the division that year. And we go to the playoffs. We win the playoffs. And we go to the Super Bowl for the first time. And we win the Super Bowl. And so it just, you know, those opportunities that existed and gave you a chance to play and fit into you know, and fit into an organization where they could use your talents. Not that I had great talents, but one that helped Franco become who he is today.
I mean, it's almost crazy cyclical, but also very roller coaster-ish. I mean, it's December 1968. You're on the Steelers. You get drafted. And then over the course of basically 6 years and a month, you go from being drafted to Vietnam to injured, back to the Steelers to the height of the Super Bowl. I mean, that is, you know, that's a crazy ride in a relatively short amount of time.
It seemed like an eternity, but it is when you put it in that context. So part of that story is not giving up. Part of the story is having a desire, you know, of what you wanted to become, having an opportunity, and then what you do with those opportunities that exist along the way. And fitting a need. And I always tell people, I said, the only reason I got a chance to play or get a chance to start wasn't because of my size and speed, two things I did not possess, but ultimately because of one talent. And I tell younger people this, and I said, we all have talents of one nature or another. To be able to be a host on a podcast or to do sports, and in this case, you know, the reason I got a chance to play was that Chuck Knoll asked our backfield coach. He said, "You have a weakness in the backfield. Who is your best blocker?" And he said, "Well, Blyer is." He said, "Well, then start him." So one talent. You know, and the ability to recognize who you had to block and wanting to do so. And so that became my opportunity to be able to break into the backfield. And it worked. And, you know, and the thing about it was that I wasn't trying to compete with Franco. I didn't do that. I knew what my job was and my responsibilities. And sometimes, you know, you get people that think that they're better than they are or should be somebody more than what they do. But actually, it's just contributing to the success of the team, because ultimately is the success of the team. Winning those Super Bowls and the people I played with allows me to be able to talk to you today about, you know, four Super Bowl champions and being a part of a great dynasty. And without those people, that would never have happened. And it's much like being in combat. Those people that surround you and take care of you, you know, and get you through a tough situation becomes essential. And it's not necessarily just you and how good you might be or not be, but it's all those parts coming together that sustain a victory, no matter what we may do.
Did any of your teammates ever ask you about Vietnam, or was it something that nobody ever bothered to bring up to you?
No, not like, you know, no. I mean, they not necessarily. No, I mean, they, you know, they asked, but it was more tongue in cheek. And, you know, I usually had a, you know, some quick comeback, you know, to talk about it, because it's, you know, it's not that they would understand and not that they really wanted to understand, I think, at that time, you know, at the time. It was a part of my life, my experience. They didn't have that same kind of experience. I don't know whether they wanted to, you know, really know, you know, what it was like, you know. So that would.
Rocky, when you see how your fellow Vietnam vets were treated when they got home, and you mentioned some of it before, and you see how veterans who are coming home are treated now, does it bother you on behalf of the guys who you saw get spat upon and sort of cursed as baby killers and everything else? Does it bother you at all?
No. I don't think it doesn't bother me. I mean, it really, it doesn't bother me, except for the fact that we didn't have that reaction back then, but I'm glad that we do have that feeling today about our service people, that we respect them for their ability to serve our country and wanting to serve our country, and not necessarily the conflict. You know, the conflict that's been going on for 18 years over in the Middle East isn't necessarily a popular, you know, a conflict, but the soldier is. I mean, the soldier today who has his multiple deployments, you know, back and forth on a professional basis, National Guard as well. Dealing with that transition from having a foot in two spots, one on a home base, secondly on a military front base, you know, so that becomes very difficult to fathom. I always tell her, I said that, you know, the biggest thing was the Gulf War going into Kuwait. I said, you know, that saved the American soldier when every night they would come on, you know, and talk about what they're going to do during the day. Colin Powell what's the general's name? God, I'm sorry. They'd come on and say, okay, fine, we're going to do here. We're going to do here. My God, they would do this. And I can remember during a period of time, you know, people would have American flags in their cars and they'd be beeping their horns. And I always wanted to relay it to how the American population perceived war. That's how they perceived war. It was like a John Wayne movie. You know, round up the wagons, you know, and we're going to do this and we're going to kick butt then, you know, and so, so that's, and we got it over with in 3 weeks and hey, that's the way we do it, you know, and from that point on, people started to think and thank, you know, the American soldier for their service. And so it became, very important. Then, when 9/11 came, you know, that was a tragedy. But again, just all escalated our feelings for the American soldier and what needed to be done and what happened here on that forefront, and then taking it all these many years later. So, yeah.
Can you think of a player who hit you in the NFL, whether in practice or a game, where you said that hurt more than getting shot?
It did, yes. Yes. Robert Brazil played linebacker for the Houston Oilers. He was an outside linebacker. It's almost like a stand-up defensive end playing a linebacker. Oh, and he was big. I mean, he was big. It was big at that time, and it, you know, like 245 pounds, and he was fast. And boy, he yeah. So every time we had to play him twice a year, and so he hit me numerous times. But there was, you know, one occasion, one game that he hit me so hard he picked me up and drove me out of bounds, and then pile drive me into the ground, and to the extent where I got up and I'm thinking, say, if you feel it right away, then you know it's going to hurt, you know, it's going to hurt. And so Robert Brazil was the guy that goes, oh man, he almost cut my career short.
So often we compare football to the military. Is there a fair comparison between the camaraderie of a military unit and the camaraderie of an NFL team?
Oh yeah, very much so. You know, because it's all, you all go through the same. We all go through the same thing. We depend on one another. We have each other's back. You know, on an athletic team as well as as an operational team, and so you know, we have the same things about. leaving or deployment or, you know, anyway, it's not necessarily the terminology, you know, that, right. that is used in sports, but it's that more sense of a family, you know, that I got your, that you have a responsibility in doing your job. You do your job. Don't try to cover for somebody else, you know. And if we all do our jobs together, you know, we're a better unit than if we don't, or if we're trying to cover a weakness that we may have. The transitions are the same too. Leaving the military after a period of time, whether it be after 4 years or 10 years or 20 years, it's a transitional period. And a lot of times, sometimes you're not prepared for that transitional. And how does that affect you? So you talk about a player, you know, that's making the team, he's playing, and then all of a sudden he's injured and he can't play anymore. And now he's, you know, a civilian. And it's like in the military, and you got plans for 20 years or 30 years, or you want to make a career, then all of a sudden an injury doesn't allow you to do that. And so now you got to make a transition into a private world. So how do you go through those problems? So, yeah, there's a great parallel between that that individual camaraderie, you know, experiences that we have, what we want to get accomplished, how do we handle the obstacles that are in front of us, how do we just become better human beings in so doing? So yeah, it's common sense, and a great relationship between the two.
I know you're very passionate about veterans' causes now. Who are you working with, and what do you hope to achieve, you know, for veterans and service members at this point?
There's a Warriors to Citizens is an organization right there in Georgia that I've been with for the last 10 years. And it's a transitional helping, especially National Guard and reservists on a professional basis. I mean, so statistically, and this is it's a family program of being able to handle moral injuries that take place in today's conflict, as well as separations, as well as we were talking about before. If you're in the National Guard, you know, how many deployments have you gone over to the Middle East? You know, a lot of times are 2-3 deployments for a period of time. And given the communication that we have today, I mean, you can be on an iPhone, you be in Iraq, and, you know, and you're talking to your wife and how's the kids or they got this. And so, you know, you're torn as a soldier in both of these worlds that go back and forth. So if you look at the statistics and divorce rates that take place and escalate because of the number of deployment, you know, it goes off the charts. And then the suicide rates that we look at overall, and it has increased during this pandemic period of time. It's information that is out there that people aren't aware of, and we thank our soldiers, but they go through a difficult time. So we Warrior Citizens, and we put on seminars and we put on families. So it's all about families and taking care of the, you know, the kids. A suicide, you know, a suicide affects 164 people. From an immediate thing, not only the family, but friends and then relatives and then the extended, and that impact that takes place. So how do we minimize that as best we possibly can and get the family unit together and the divorce rates down? So that is it's a wonderful program that I'm involved in there. Now the second one is beating the odds, and it's an educational program that we start in high school and take it over into, and that is just overcoming obstacles and having stepping stones of success and learning those stepping stones of success and how important that is. And I've been with them for We started that 30 years ago, Rocco Scalzi and myself. And so it starts within the classroom, and we tell stories about military people and so on along those steps, and how important it is, because a lot of that stuff isn't really taught today in schools on what you look for from to be a success, having dreams and goals, you know, and having a plan, knowing what your resources are, where you're going to go, and you get into trouble, you know, how do you find an answer and move forward? And so those are, you know, those are two big ones. And then always, obviously, no matter where we may go in today's society, there's local chapters of veterans here and do great stuff about homeless veterans and support mechanisms and so on. So, I get involved as maybe sometimes more than I should, but it's such a great cause.
Rock, 74 years young. What's next for you personally?
That's right. Well, I got I got a construction company here in Pittsburgh, and so we've been in the construction business for the last 15 years, and we started off with an opportunity being a service-disabled, veteran-owned small business, and we morphed that business and built it, and so now we're into the moving into the private sector, so we do a lot of VA work as well as we've had in the past in healthcare and in the hospitals, and so now we're doing and we're building, and so that becomes very exciting. So that's carrying me on, you know. So that becomes my focus and my passion, and besides having a chance to talk to people like you, so that's great.
Well, Rocky, again, it's an amazing story. I know maybe some people have heard it before. I hope we got to some detail that maybe people haven't known about or didn't hear before. And I just love your candor and your honesty and the amount of emotion and passion that you communicate your story with, I think is something that's going to resonate with all of our veterans and all of the fans of this show and listeners of the show.
Well, thank you. Thank you. We enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. So thank you for what you do as well.
Rocky Blyer, thank you for being part of the Hazard Ground podcast.
Okay.
You've been listening to the Hazard Ground Podcast, hosted by Mark Zeno and produced by Matt Pascarella. If you have an interesting story to tell and you'd like to be on the show, send us an email at hazardgroundpodcast@gmail.com. And if you like the show, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review on iTunes. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.